that I've mentioned but not named as the one that I did not like a whole lot, in the sense that it does not resonate with me, so we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. This last quote here is, "When we put it plainly like this, as a direct choice between God and our stuff, most of us hope we would choose God, but we need to realize that how we spend our time, what our money goes towards, and where we will invest our energy is equivalent to choosing God or rejecting him," right? This is kind of a, not a new topic. It's just basically the idea of idolatry in our lives. We can kind of track down where our priorities are based on where our money goes, where our time goes, where our energy goes, right? Where do we really invest those non-renewable resources when it comes to our time and energy? Where do we put our time? That's the idea. And we're here this morning talking about this. It's probably a good indication that we're on the right track. I think so, at least. Things pop up from time to time. But definitely when it comes to an overall view of where our priority is, you can kind of see that from standing back and looking at where you are a lot of the times. Okay, questions, comments about that one? Eddie had a bunch of things he was saying while he's watching us at home last week, he said.
Yeah, I caught myself answering out loud.
Yeah. Did you raise your hand first?
Raise your hand.
No, but I couldn't understand why you didn't hear me.
Yeah, weird. It's not two-way. It's strange. Okay, next chapter. Well, let's really go to the next chapter. Chapter 6, When You're in Love is the title of this one. And the first thing he talks about is the idea of his grandmother, his wife's grandmother, Clara. Or I guess it's Clara, right? Not Clara. It's Clara.
Clara.
What?
Clara.
Clara? Okay, just thought so. And the idea was he saw in the example of his wife's grandmother that she was someone who was in love with Jesus, meaning she talked about him all the time, would spend time in the Word of God, talked about him like they were in a relationship when it comes to like a relationship. And so how do you feel about that illustration of being in love with Jesus? Okay, he's your best friend. What about you? How do you relate to Jesus in your life, in that relationship? Just by the way, our sermon this morning, but beside the point.
I think that using that terminology in love, I've never gotten that before. You have to be careful with emotion versus, you know, how you really should act towards God.
Yeah, I have a hard time with that in love part, just because when I think of I'm in love with someone, I'm not in love with my work. I love my work. I enjoy what I do. I wouldn't do anything else. I'm in love with my wife. I'm not in love with my children, right? I love them. That's my problem. The in love thing to me is reserved for my wife. Just in my own mental way that grammar breaks down. If I say I'm in love with my children, does that sound weird to you?
Yeah.
It sounds really weird to me. So if I say I'm in love with Jesus, I don't know. It does not resonate with me at all. I get what he's saying here, I think, is the idea of loving God in an emotional way, in a passionate way, in an intimate way, in the sense of that we have an intimate relationship with him about knowing our hearts, and we can go to him whenever we have an issue. I get that. But that little phrase of in love with Christ, I have a little bit of hesitancy to say I'm on board with that. Hilton?
When you asked the question, I didn't know if I was going to say it today or not. But I've always, number one, I had the utmost respect for my father. He made sure as a kid that I did have respect for him.
Yeah.
But
they help along
as
the
an
way.
Adult, I still had the utmost respect for my father.
Right.
And I always tried to do things to please him as an adult. And that's the relationship that I thought that I had with Christ and God, thinking that I was a good Christian because I had the utmost respect for them.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of the reverent fear kind of deal, right? Like you respect him because you know his power, you know his position, you know how he's guided you along this life in an unseen way, right? And so That's the only thing I've got with this chapter, is that little caveat of in love. I don't really, does not resonate with me. But everything else in the chapter, I think, if we just kind of change it from in love to love or respect or fear, makes it a bit clearer for me. I don't know what it is, but it doesn't hit home for me. He quotes John Piper here. The critical question for our generation and for every generation is this. If you could have heaven with no sickness and with all the friends you've ever had on earth and all the food you ever liked and all the leisure activities you enjoyed and all the natural beauties you ever saw, all the physical pleasures you've ever tasted and no human conflict or any natural disasters, could you be satisfied with heaven if Christ was not there? Very interesting question. Because when you think about what's so good about heaven, what do you think about? God? Why do you want to go there?
Because what we're told, no more tears, no more pain, no more suffering, no more cares, no more bills to pay. I mean, it's all positive.
I think the question is, why are there no more of those things? Especially the bills part.
He's asking, could you do this if Christ wasn't there? I've never thought of any separation. That's heaven is Christ, heaven is God.
Yeah. That's the answer. The reason why it's so good in heaven is the embodiment of God is good is there and is his fullest glory. If you want all these positive things without the one that makes positive possible, it's a fallibility, right? The idea here is, or fallacy rather, these things are all one and the same. Every good and perfect gift comes down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or turning, right? James says, the half-brother of Jesus said that all good things come from basically his older brother. So the idea of him saying that every good you've ever experienced has come from God, that's a reality. And so the idea of separating all the good things that we want about heaven without God being there is not possible. But if we just pretend that maybe it could be for a second, that we can separate those two categories, would you want to go to a place that he describes here, as John Piper writes, but Christ not being there, God not being there? Our aim should be no, right? But in reality, though, when it comes to the situation, he's trying to kind of lead us towards the thought that maybe that's why the church overall, in the worldview and the American use of that term, is the way that it is because we're hyping up all the goodness stuff and forgetting all the things about God that we don't want to talk about. So that's one.
It's hard to
go ahead.
Quantify or equate to, because basically what he's describing is the best vacation ever.
Yeah.
And we always know reality comes in, so yeah.
Yeah.
It's hard to equate that. I'm phrasing it right, but just hard to separate.
Yeah, it is. It's really impossible, Joanne.
That describes the human world that we're living in, and we're wanting to go to a spiritual world with God.
Right. Yeah, but we only have, you know, human words, physical words to describe these spiritual things, right? It's a whole different realm. It's interesting. The deeper you go into it, the more it all kind of rolls back on itself. All right, so this kind of dovetails into what Eric was talking about last week towards the end, the idea of he makes it seem so hard to live the Christian life, but Christ talks about the idea of his yoke is easy, his burden is light. This is kind of where this dovetails. My fear in writing the previous chapter is that it only invokes in you fear and guilt, which is why, by the way, I spent so much time trying to set that up properly, because you can leave chapters 4 and 5 and say, whoa, this is just, you know, too tough. Personal experience has taught me that actions driven by fear and guilt are not an antidote to lukewarm, selfish, or comfortable living. I hope you realize instead that the answer is love. Let me give you an illustration about how I find this to be absolutely true. Let's say we notice that there happens to be people not coming back for Sunday afternoon worship, right? It's a huge drop-off, just a small but a huge drop-off. What is the solution to that issue? First of all, is that an issue to begin with?
I think it is.
Okay. Why is it an issue? We'll put it that way.
I think, you know, the elders have set aside that time for us to be together. I know James 4:17 is probably taken out of context, but to do good is right.
Yeah.
Right? And to want to be with one another. Do we not want to be with one another, you know?
Yeah.
I do.
Okay, so given the opportunity, if we had the chance, if we had the ability, meaning our lives are not so congested at the moment that we make a habit of it, but just the idea of if we're able to make it back for a second worship service in the afternoon, should we try to do that? I say, yeah, fair enough. I'm here. You know, I prepare stuff for you for a very selfish reason. I like some folks to be here to hear what I prepared for you to present, to give you the food that you need spiritually to help you this next week. That's kind of one idea. But let's say I've been tasked with the job of trying to encourage more people to come back or to come to Sunday morning worship for that matter, right? How would you approach it? Well, what I've done before is the old tried and true method of Hebrews, right? Go there, say, not forsaking the assembling of some is, right? The idea there is saying, well, the Bible says you should be here, therefore, if you're not, you're sinning. Now, what's the motivating factor there?
Well,
guilt.
I mean,
you all say guilt at the same time.
You, a few weeks ago, I know you don't want to go back to Bible stuff, but a few weeks ago, before we started this book, you introduced the book of Philemon in a one-week class. And in there, he says that he is appealing to him for love's sake, that your gift will be
not a compulsion.
That you want to do, and not that you feel like you're compelled to do. So I would say that, you know, appealing for love's sake is usually the way that we try to do with our children at some point, once they just don't do what we say exactly without thinking about it.
The consequence. So it's better, it's a higher motivating skill to be able to motivate someone to do something because of love, as opposed to guilt, fear, shame, right? Maddie is at the level now to where she knows that she can just tell us no. We've had to address that this week repeatedly, constantly, and consistently. The idea of asking her to do something and she just says nope and just walks off. Has been trying this week. It's been great.
I bet it's really cute, though.
What's that?
I said, I bet it's really cute, though.
I mean, yeah, it's cute. It's cute when I don't throw her against the wall out of frustration. I've been a housewife, basically, this week, being at home every single day. And I got to tell you, I mean, you couldn't pay me all the money in the world. So, anyway, appreciate you guys. What was my point? Okay, so we were trying to get to a point of maturity where fear and threatening and guilt and shame and spankings and taking away toys and that kind of thing is not the motivating thing, right? Like, I don't want to lose something precious. I don't want to feel bad. Therefore, I'll give in, right? It works, I guess, in the short term. But it doesn't really change your relationship. Like, do you remember in your own parent relationship, either with your parents or with your children, when it switched over and you noticed it for the first time? When it was no longer, I'm afraid of the punishment, and then it became, well, I love my parent, or my child loves me enough to listen to what I had to say. Hopefully you've had that. I distinctly remember in my own mind when that happened. It wasn't that I was afraid of my mom's spankings because they didn't work anymore. I was afraid of the slap in the face, for sure. She got me on that one. But it changed to a point to where it's like, well, I love my mom, and she loves me, and she wants me to do this for my own good. I appreciate that. I'm gonna show her I love her by respecting her enough to do so. That's what he's trying to say here, is he's not trying to guilt trip us into feeling bad about our own relationship with God, where we spend our time, how we come to church, what's our mindset, where our money goes. That's all temporary. But if it comes from a place of love, that we love God enough and love one another enough that we want to change our lives to reflect that, that's the higher experience, right? What are your thoughts about that? Or any suggestions about what I can do with this kid? No, we'll save that for later.
My dad always taught us as the kids that the doors were open, we were there. That was, there was no debate, no conversation. When the doors were open at the church, we were there.
Yeah.
And that's the way we were raised.
The one,
I feel that way, and I can't do it any other way.
I love the fact that she's a 3-year-old, right? So, you know, complexity is not really her speed right now. It's all some simplistic stuff for good reason. She's 3. Let her enjoy that. But whenever we pray at the night, every single night, she says, and then she prays that tomorrow we can go to church and see our friends. That's how she phrases it. Like every night, we're like, okay, we'll go on Wednesday or we'll go on Sunday. She's like, oh, okay. But she kind of is not there yet. But it's just, she enjoys being around people that love her, that want to spend time with her, give her attention, obviously. She's 3. And the idea of we get to a point where we say, well, I don't really want to be around my church friends. That's not quite it, right? Okay, there is so often a great disparity between how we feel about faith and how we are meant to feel. Why do so few people genuinely find joy and pleasure in their relationship with God? Why do most people feel they either have to pay God back for all he's done, meaning by his love, or somehow keep making up for all their inadequacies and failures by proving their love? So the idea there of how we feel about what God's given us is an interesting thought. How do you feel about it in your own life? God saved you for eternity, right? He wants to be your father. He wants you to be his son or daughter. He wants to be with you for all eternity. And how do you really, on the inside, feel about that dynamic?
Totally blessed.
Totally blessed.
Thankful.
Okay.
Thankful.
Anybody brave enough to give me something besides the good answers?
Okay.
Unworthy?
Yeah, I can say, I guess unworthy, or, you can't live up to deserving, the blessings and that he gives us the grace. And
I think I've shared my experiences more than a handful of times, first becoming a Christian and not really understanding the dynamic of what this relationship is all about. Thinking, my standard is Christ, but I'm never going to get there, so why even try? That's a huge stumbling block for me when I first started. And then the idea of, he's blessed me so much that I can never pay him back, so I can't do anything good, feeling inadequate. This is all me bringing everything else from my life to this new relationship with God that I couldn't really understand, because I've mentioned publicly before, my understanding of God as my father had a lot of baggage that came along with that. So that was tough. It took me a long time to kind of wade through those emotions, recognize what they were, first of all, and not just trying to deceive myself and push through it. Just recognize how I feel, express that to God, and then try to read more and understand more to change that dynamic. It's maturity, right? It takes time to kind of mold it. Okay, Psalm 63, 1-5. O God, you are my God. Earnestly I seek you. My soul thirsts after you. My body longs for you in a dry and weary land where there is no water. Ever been thirsty before?
Hugo? No water for 2 days.
2 days. 2 days is a long time.
Yeah, it is.
Let's question it. This morning, this is not comparing to you, but this morning I was in the car and I took my my antibiotic for my sinuses, and I did it on an empty stomach, which if you know how that feels, it's kind of like taking a multivitamin on an empty stomach, which I do not recommend, because you get that whole swirling, churning, I'm going to get sick feeling for a little bit. And so I'm driving in the car, I'm driving towards Starbucks to get my hot beverage for this morning to keep my throat nice and relaxed. And we get to a red light. I'm like, I am so thirsty. Like, I had a lot of water last night. I've been drinking all this kind of water at home for the whole week. I can't be dehydrated, but I need water right now. And then I remember I have a water bottle right next to my left leg. Literally, I could just reach down and grab the water and just drink the water and just not be thinking, I'm so thirsty. Just get over it and grab the water. I forgot it was there. In a similar kind of way in life, we can forget that God is so close. Right? We're going through something and we are just in our head and we are just churning and thinking about this modern thing that we're going through, this thing that's immediate in front of us, and kind of forget that our source of help is right there. So that's kind of where I think about when I read this passage. Anyway, I have seen you in the sanctuary. By the way, where's the sanctuary here in this context?
Temple.
The temple, right? Okay. And beheld your power and glory, because your love is better than life, my lips will glorify you. Let's read it again. Because your love is better than life, the psalmist says, my lips will glorify you. I will praise you as long as I live, and in your name I will lift up my hands. What's that, by the way? Lifting up your hands? Praising. That's literally the word picture here, praise. It's the Hebrew word for praise, lifting up your hands. My soul be satisfied as with the richest of foods, and with singing lips my mouth will praise you. So it's a different relationship, right? That's a whole lot different than God, you know, you saved me from my sins. I feel so bad about myself. I feel so guilty that you had to pay that price for me. It's not one of shame and guilt. It's one of glorification because you recognize what he's done for us. Okay, thoughts? That's why we worship, right? That should be the intent, right? Okay. We'll go back and read this part. The answer lies in the idea of changing from that guilt-shame factor to the factor of love. The answer lies in letting him change you. Remember his counsel to the lukewarm church in Laodicea. Here I am. I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in and eat with him. I will commune with him, is the concept there. And he with me. His counsel was not to try harder, but rather to let him in. As James wrote, come near to God, and he will come or draw near to you. But the idea there is, whose help do we need to love him more? We need God's. I think a huge, huge factor in this not only is experience, you know, living through things in life that shows you God can pull you through them, but also his word. I think his word is the key, because everything comes back to what he's revealed to us about him in the book, right? How do we learn about God in the first place?
His word, huh?
His word. So if you learn about his existence, his nature, his demands, his sacrifice in the word, where do you go for help?
In the word.
In the word. The thing that taught you about him in the first place.
Alan,
yep.
In Colossians, what we studied in the Bible, all that Paul said that he had a great conflict, not only with the Colossians, but Laodicea. And every time I hear that now, I think of it because he's saying I have a conflict because you haven't seen my face in the flesh. And although there might be many meanings behind it, what always struck me was, is what he was saying, I'm writing to you, and I want you to know me. Not know of me, but know me.
Yeah.
And that's what I think of whenever we're with Laodicea, with lukewarm, whatever, not just that you know of Jesus, but that you know him. He wants that personal relationship.
Yeah, that's tough to get to, right?
And that's what we want, we're talking about,
yeah.
Trying to get through this stuff.
Right.
Meaning the stuff, meaning life.
Yeah, stuff of life. When I read the Psalms, he says, I witness an extreme intimacy that at times seems unattainable. I have to remind myself constantly that the Psalms are written by people just like me. And I completely amen him on that, because sometimes I just kind of forget that most of the times David is writing as a fallible guy like me. That the things that he writes by inspiration are just so profound that we can experience that as well, in a way. They enjoyed closeness with God that you and I can experience. We should be communicating these words to him. Psalm 132:2. I'll just read the verses now. Like a weaned child with his mother, like a weaned child is my soul within me. I mean, how close is a mother and a child relationship at that stage? You think Luke likes me? He likes me. He likes laughing at my face for some reason. He loves when I throw him up in the air and catch him. He likes that. He likes when I'm across the room and he can crawl me real quick and then look and then drool and then look and then crawl real quick. But if I'm holding him and then Melissa walks by, arms are out, right? That's how David said he feels, basically, about his soul when it comes to God. You have filled my heart with greater joy than when their grain and new wine abound. I will lie down and sleep in peace, for you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety. That dichotomy here of saying, you have filled my heart with greater joy than when their grain and new wine abound. He's saying, I am more satisfied by you than when the harvest time comes. Right? You made me known. You have made known to me the path of life. You will fill me with joy in your presence, with eternal pleasures at your right hand. The Lord is my strength and my shield. My heart trusts in him, and I am helped. My heart leaps for joy, and I will give thanks to him in song. Satisfy us in the morning with your unfailing love, that we may sing for joy and be glad for all our days. Your statutes are my heritage forever. They are the joy of my heart. And he says here, I don't want to make it sound deceptively easy, but the Psalms are also filled with cries of pain. Hear my prayer, O Lord. Listen to my cry for help. Do not be deaf to my weeping. Out of the depths of love I cry to you, O Lord. O Lord, hear my voice. Let your ears be attentive to my cries for mercy. Jesus said, in this world you will have trouble, but take heart. I have overcome the world. I remember, by the way, the first time I ever read that passage, my King James Ondervan Study Bible, I underlined it, and then I took a pink highlighter and highlighted that junk. I was like, I can overcome it because Christ has overcome everything in this world. I'm having a problem with everything in this world. So, okay, he's the guy. Life isn't perfect when you follow Christ wholeheartedly, but you will have trouble. Jesus says it's pretty much guaranteed. But he has overcome the world. So take heart, keep on, fight the good fight, pray continuously, and do not grow weary. There is nothing better than giving up everything and stepping into a passionate love relationship with God, the God of the universe who has made galaxies, leaves, laughter, and me and you. It's a pretty good thought, I think. So what are your thoughts about that? Gary, your face says your wheels are turning.
You know, First John would write that, you know, that they had seen God, they had handled God, they had touched God.
Yeah.
They had, and then he says, we're going to write these things that you may know what we've seen, what we've heard. We develop that relationship like we've never developed a relationship before in most cases, and that's based on a word, personal words. You know, it's something we've never done before. I mean, I know women that write to prisoners and
I was thinking the same exact thing you just said, yeah.
And marry them, never seeing them. Well, you know, go to prison and marry them and stuff, but it's just something we've never done. And, you know, we're basing it on words. We're developing a love based on words and what he's done for us that we see in this word.
Let me blow my nose and make a comment.
That's a first.
Okay. It's a big pet peeve of mine to blow my nose in public, but I got to do it. It is an interesting way to forge a new relationship, only through words, right? We talk to him. He talks back to us in a way through his word. We don't really hear that voice, right? Or at least we shouldn't. If you do, talk to a professional, right? No, the idea there is it's a unique relationship, and that's why it's built on faith, right? But in a similar kind of way, I fell in love with Melissa almost like 3 days after our dating, our relationship began. She had a yearbook, and 3 days after dating her, I said, I want to write 3 words in there. She's like, what are you talking about? And I was like, oh, not those 3 words. Like lying to make her seem like calm down a little bit. But no, I loved Melissa. But I didn't really know her as well as I know her now. But a big part of that was her being able to communicate to me what she was thinking and feeling and all that. And this is before, really before texting was a huge thing. It was around, but we didn't have cell phones. So we did the old pass a note in class. So she would write a little note or a letter. She'd fold it up in some fancy origami way and then hand to me in the hallway. So the next class, I'd go and open, read it. So I learned about my future wife and who she was and what she was thinking and how she was feeling through words. We would come together and we would talk. It wouldn't be as intimate as it was in the notes. She wasn't great at expressing it verbally. I wasn't great in anything emotional, just generally. I was just deadened to that, so that was great. And so the idea of being able to look at a page that she wrote and to feel her emotions in that page really began our relationship in that kind of way. So in a similar kind of way, here we are learning about God from God, His Spirit, that was driving and carrying along these human authors to express from their own vocabulary, their own experiences, who God was. And so we're kind of hearing from God and also hearing from someone else who has that relationship with Him what God is all about. And so kind of by association, we get to know Him, right? That's the way, it's unusual, but that's the apparently most efficient way to do it. And what other way could He have done it reliably? And to make it through faith, you know? I guess He could have.
I also find that I can see in someone's life how dedicated they are to the Lord, how they live their lives, how they relate to people, how they treat children, how they don't kick their dog. I mean, you can tell. You can tell someone who loves God because they've read and they've been taught and they know. And so they live that kind of a life.
Those are fruits, right?
Fruits.
And Christ said, "You shall know them by their fruits." Let me tell you a story. I'm not going to say any names or locations for my own sake. There were a couple of people that we used to go out to lunch with in the afternoons after morning worship. And I respected these people. They were good Christian examples, I thought. But almost every single week, when it came to a waitress or a waiter coming to our table and taking our food order and then bringing us food, they were extremely rude, almost every week, to the point of being like, I was embarrassed to be seated with these individuals. And not to say they're bad Christians or anything, but that was a huge impact on me to say like, wow, like we just left worshiping God together. And here we are trying to have a positive impact, to be lights in the world, salt of the earth. And you're treating this poor person who has to work today, making money off tips, like garbage? Like, that's a bad fruit, right? It's a rotten fruit. Not saying that all other fruits are bad, but that one was a big one to me. And that still sticks with me, that I will never be rude to my waiter or waitress, especially on Sunday afternoons when they know we're church people, you know. You already got enough stacked against us. Like, why add one more thing to the plate of why not to go to church? So that's one thing.
I used to wait tables for a long time in Barton, and when the Sunday crowd, we'll call it, because they're not Christians, most of them aren't, they're religious people.
Yeah.
When they would come in, even the people I work with would dread it because they would treat them like a servant in a negative way, not in a loving, kind way. And then they had the audacity to leave their little pamphlet with crummy tips on top of it. So, like, how are you even trying to represent God when you're being disrespectful, you're leaving a bad tip, and then you're throwing some garbage material is not even biblically accurate at people, and I told him it wasn't even real stuff.
Yeah.
Not real.
Yeah.
Ask Jesus in your heart for it.
Believers in doubt.
Yeah.
Well, that's where that comes from, right?
Well, how do Pharisees and Sadducees do it?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's the fruits, right? I mean, Christ had a problem with a lot of people when he was here. Like, God had a problem with a lot of people when he came in the first century, right? Mm-hmm. Who are the people he had the most problem with? Religious
people. Pharisees and Sadducees.
Yeah. So that's a huge lesson to you and me to watch out for. When you get religious, you can really become Pharisaical really easily. Think you're doing the right thing because you think you're doing the right thing for God, and then really, you know, be like the Pharisees. So they said they were dead on the inside. Okay.
And not doing one thing to lift somebody's burden.
Yeah.
Just keep piling it on.
Yeah, quick. I'm going to have a tax off for every Pauline book you quote. I'm going to tax you one credit card for my dream. So what if I do believe that he's overcome the world until his kingdom comes, which we can fight about that if you want. What about the sin I can't seem to escape? What about my messed up family? What about my past with my grandma's cancer? What about the car accident that killed my friend? What about the divorce? So we can easily say he's overcome the world, but we really should realize what that fully means in the sense of the world and all the things that go along with the world. When Satan came before God and all the angels, God said, "From whence do you come?" in the King James. I don't know how to say it in English correctly. What do you say?
Roaming to and fro.
Roaming is one translation of it. The idea is ruling is the other.
Right.
Ruling to and fro all across the earth. So what's Satan saying to God himself? Where are you coming from? Well, I'm coming from my domain, the world that I rule, going back and forth over across. That thing that you made so holy and perfect, that thing that I perverted by introducing the idea of questioning your word, that's my domain now. And it is, for a little bit.
Right.
But we know the guy's overcoming. Right? That's the idea. God tells us that we are getting the better end of the deal, that we will be rewarded in a manner that far outweighs our current frustrations and hardships, and even that we are blessed when men hate you, when they exclude you, and insult you and reject your name as evil because of the Son of Man. Rejoice in that day and leap for joy because great is your reward in heaven. This next part I love. They called the apostles in and had them flogged, which is, by the way, what's flogging, by the way?
Beating with a cat of nine tails sometimes?
Specific, but yeah, they were beaten. Here usually it would be canes is the idea, and not just, you know, like walking stick, but like rule of thumb canes. Then they ordered them not to speak in the name of Jesus and let them go. The apostles left the Sanhedrin, by the way, exactly where Jesus was right before they went to Pontius. So they were in the exact same spot, Sanhedrin, rejoicing because they had been counting, they had been counted worthy of suffering disgrace for the name. Day after day, in the temple courts and from house to house, they never stopped teaching and proclaiming the good news that Jesus is the Christ. That little addition, the apostles left rejoicing because they had been counted worthy of suffering disgrace for the name. I wonder what that looked like physically. Were they literally jumping for joy? Were they smiling? Were they laughing about it? Were they having, like, I can't believe we got to suffer for his namesake? This, the way that it's said here in English is just so specific. We never face adversity like that, do we? I don't. Something bad happens to me for the sake of Christ, I say, wow, so happy about that. Can't believe I got a chance to suffer. No, it's the paradox of Christianity, right? Okay, questions, comments, quotes from Paul? Okay. Like I said, this chapter, I think it's great. Besides that little thing that I can't get over is the way he phrases the in love with Christ, but whatever. Malachi 1:1, God says, from the rising of the sun or 1:11 rather, from the rising of the sun even to its setting, my name will be great among the nations. In every place, incense is going to be offered to my name, and a grain offering that is pure, for my name will be great among the nations. By the way, is this talking about the Jewish world or the Christian world? Nope. Nope, not Malachi. Malachi was there when the temple was already done, and his big problem was they were not offering the best stuff. But in here, for my name will be great among the nations. Nations talking about the Gentiles as well. So we have that foreshadow of in the Christian era, this is how great God is going to be proclaimed to everybody because of how great he is. God tells the priests that they don't want to give him excellence, others will. Talking about if the Jews, the Levitical priesthood will not offer the best stuff, there's going to be a time when they're not the only ones to offer for God. God says his name will be great among the nations. Right now, 100 million angels are praising God's name. He certainly doesn't need to beg or plead with us. That's something that's hard for me to wrap my mind around, besides just the number. God doesn't need us.
He wants us.
Really, for anything. Right? In Acts 17, the idea of Paul in Athens, he says, it's not like God needs you to build him a house. He made everything. It's not like he needs you to offer food or wine or any such thing, since in him we live and breathe and have our own being. He's like, God's everywhere. God made all of this. He doesn't need it from us, but like Gary said, he wants it from us. Do we need our children to pick up their toys when they're done playing with them?
No, we need a force flex to put the toys in.
Okay. No, we could do it ourselves. Right? We could. Trust me, you can if you have to. This week, I have picked up a lot of toys. But why do we want them to do it?
Teaching responsibility.
It's a little bit different. Teach them something about responsibility, clean up for themselves, kind of make them more mature. It's for their own benefit. Right, and just use that small, silly illustration to prove that God doesn't need us, but he's been trying to move us, carry us along this path to grow in our relationship with him because it's in our own best interest. If he's the source of all that is light and life and goodness, wouldn't it be best if we were to be with him forever? Yeah. So he's trying to show us what living with him for eternity is, so we can make the decision for ourselves. One thought. Anything else? Gary?
When you look at Scripture, you see how much effort God had to put forth for the scheme of redemption from Genesis 3:15 and woven all through the Bible to the pinnacle of Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And to think that we're not going to be able to be brought into the fold, or we're not good enough, which we're not, but God has gone to great lengths for us to be saved. He doesn't dangle a carrot, the old proverbial carrot right in front of our face, and we can't reach it.
Yeah.
It's there, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it is.
I think Gary's right in, he wants it, you know, or he wants us to, you know, love and trust in him, but I think registers better for me that he wants it for us as opposed to that he just wants us to do it.
Right.
You know, and I think about my parents and all the things that, you know, they wanted me to do. They didn't need me to do it.
Yeah.
You know, but they wanted me to do it, and they really wanted it for me more so than anything else.
Yeah. All right, the last quote of the book or the chapter that we'll close out. How do we progress? How do we, if we're being disingenuous with our relationship with him, how do we change that? How do we work on that? Well, here's his suggestion. Don't fool him, but instead, tell him how you feel. Tell him that he isn't the most important thing in this life to you, and that you're sorry for that. Tell him that you've been lukewarm. Tell him that you've chosen something over him time and time again. Tell him that you want him to change you, that you long to genuinely enjoy him. Tell him how you experience true, how you want to experience true satisfaction and pleasure and joy in your relationship with him. Tell him that you want to love him more than anything on this earth. Tell him you want to treasure the kingdom of heaven so much that you'd be willing to sell everything in order to get it. Tell him what you like about him, what you appreciate, and what brings you joy. Yeah, I mean, don't forget that you can talk to him, right? He's got an open ear to how you feel. He knows it already, but by you expressing it, and sometimes verbally, it can help not only him to know how you feel, but also you to know how you feel. So you can make those changes if necessary along the way. Okay, anything else? If not, we'll be dismissed now and pick up chapter 7 next week. Thank you for your time and your attention.